wonder if God got a plan for everyone. I wonder if I could take a second run. 'Cause I carry on getting sad and getting stuck. What I wouldn't give for a life that doesn't suck. I'm a moving target.
Back to S3 Podcast, episode 64. Will is Skin Yogurt Shop Murders, part 2, Confidence. Before we get right into it, just want to say, do head on over to our Instagram, S3Podcast_. We are also on Facebook, the S3 Podcast Official. And also subscribe to our podcast on your chosen platform. Without further ado, let's get right into it. So, on the evening of December 6th, 1991, four teenage girls were murdered inside of a yogurt shop in Austin, Texas. Two of the girls were 17-year-old employees of the yogurt, Jennifer Harbison and Eliza Thomas, while the other two were Jennifer's 15-year-old sister and her 13-year-old best friend, Sarah Harbison and Amy Ayers. The bodies of all four were found after a patrolling police officer found smoke coming from the yogurt shop at around midnight. Within minutes, the location was crawling with more than a dozen firefighters who had quickly killed the flame, but then found the bodies in the back area of the yogurt shop. Throughout a lengthy investigation, police were determined that the victims had been forced to undress and were then bound in their own clothing before being shot in the back of the head. All had been shot at least once, but the youngest victim, Amy Ayers, whose body was found separated from the other three by several feet, had been shot twice. It will later be revealed that at least one 38 caliber shell and slug would be recovered from the crime scene, in addition to four 22 caliber bullets which were taken from the victims' bodies. The fire, which alerted officials to the scene, had been started intentionally. The culprits had gathered material from around the store and placed it around the victims before starting the blaze. It is believed that they did so to try and destroy evidence, but the decision ultimately led police to discover the crime scene rather quickly, potentially just minutes after the fire was started. It always, in a way, perturbs me, if that's the right wording to use, that if this was a general robbery, right, where you'd go in, rob money and go back out again, that is understandable. But for these two culprits to not only scout the place, well, and obviously go in there and rob whatever money they could get a hold of, right, but to then escalate it even further to murdering all four girls, was that part of their plan? Was part of their plan to tie them up and then to keep them quiet and then to flee the scene? Or did something else happen between them going in to the shop to rob them, and something happened in between that led them to killing these four young girls? Or and their plan obviously backfired, and that's what led to them going this extra step? Or was it their intention all along? That's something that, you know, we probably will never find out. But as you can imagine, this crime would shock the community, with its horrifying and tragic nature leading to a drastic overhaul throughout Austin. Residents became desperate for answers, and the Austin Police Department, who attempted to hit the ground running with their investigation, desperately tried to provide them. Approximately 8 days after the murders, police received one of their first solid leads. It came in the form of a local teenager, 16-year-old Maurice Pierce, who had been arrested at the North Cross Mall for unlawfully carrying a loaded 22 caliber pistol in his waistband, along with more than a dozen rounds in his pocket. Pierce had been arrested alongside his friend, Forrest Wellborn, whom he then began to throw under the bus during an extensive police interview. So basically, I'm not falling for this one, I'm not going down for this one, you're going to take the fall. So, you know, generic tactics being played. During an interview with detectives about the loaded weapon that he was found carrying, Maurice Pierce admitted that it was the murder weapon from the crime that had shocked Austin the week prior. However, he admitted this while also confessing that he had loaned the weapon to his friend, Forrest, who had been arrested at the mall alongside him. But in the same interview, Pierce confessed to fleeing Austin a day after the murders, alongside Forrest and two of their teenage friends, named Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott, whom he claims had stolen a Nissan Pathfinder with them and driven to San Antonio for a weekend getaway. This interview was conducted by a headstrong and perhaps overzealous detective named Hector Polanco, who would go on to play a vital role in this case. But for the time being, Polanco was just an investigator with a hunch who managed to get a delinquent to talk to him and confess his involvement in the area's most high-profile case. This was seen as a major win for him and the Austin Police Department for now. Police would later subject both Maurice Pierce and Forrest Wellborn to polygraph tests, which they passed, as well as in-depth police interviews grilling them about their involvement in the yogurt shop murders. Pierce was unable to provide much more in the way of proof, offering up little more than his word, while Wellborn denied his involvement entirely. Police even arranged for Pierce to wear a wire and attempt to implicate Wellborn that way, but Forrest refused to bite. Other than the two admitting to being down the street from the yogurt shop on the night of the murders at the North Cross Mall, where most of the area's teens hung out on weekends, police had nothing, even the 22 caliber pistol that Pierce was found to be carrying, was unable to be linked to the murders, with ballistics coming back inconclusive. Detectives would later clear both the boys of involvement in the crime, believing that Maurice Pierce, a teenage dropout with a middle school education, had a mental problem that caused him to falsely implicate both his friends and himself in the murders. Now, you see, this part annoys me because so what if Maurice Pierce had a mental health problem? Having a mental health problem does not make you, you know, a liar or make you falsely implicate anyone. I don't buy that, and as someone who suffers from mental health, right, that suffering from a mental illness that's not how it works. So I hate the use of that word mental problem. Like as if that's gonna be his main prerogative or objective in falsely accusing. Maybe, right, he was just doing what every person who gets arrested does. They palm the blame off onto the person. I don't call that a mental problem. I just hate the word or the use of that. But anyway, APD Sergeant John Jones, who had been overseeing the case alongside his partner Mike Huckabee, had been the only homicide detective working on the night of the crime. As such, he was the first detective to arrive at the scene that night and became the de facto lead investigator. In his police report regarding Maurice Pierce's confession, in which Pierce had implicated his friend, Forrest Wellborn, Sergeant Jones wrote, "It was obvious to everyone that Pierce was trying to force the issue on Wellborn, who appeared to have no idea what Pierce was talking about." Sergeant Jones also wrote that Pierce was lying and had just made up the whole story about the gun being used. So that seemed to be that both Maurice Pierce and Forrest Wellborn were released from custody, cleared of any involvement in this case, and allowed to proceed with their lives. A week later, Sergeant Jones would speak to the press about this confession and others, which had started to inundate himself and other investigators. Confessions sound good, but that's not the standard by which charges are filed. If we have the right person, we will charge them. A confession alone isn't enough to get a conviction, which I would agree. The killers have to tell us certain things that only the killers would know. That didn't happen in this case. They started telling us stuff that wasn't true. They were giving information that they had heard of off the street. However, in the years to come, this original confession would go on to cast an incredibly large shadow over this story and go on to ultimately derail the investigation entirely. In the weeks after the murders of the four girls in Austin, investigators had hit the pavement hoping to quickly figure out who had committed this heinous crime. Even though APD's homicide division only had 6 full-time investigators, 4 of them were assigned to this case, later being enlisted in a task force aimed solely at cracking this case. So that's a hell of a lot of work for 6 men to, you know. And as we all know, again, if you have listened to podcasts in true crime, you know that, you know, for as much good the police do, there's always some, mistakes along the way, you know. So, first, police attempted to tie this crime to others that had occurred in the area around it. Then they began to speculate that it was a drug-related crime, possibly committed by some local drug addicts. But likewise, that proved to be a dead end. Roughly 1 week after the murders, a call would be received by 911 dispatchers, informing them that the killers of the teenage girls in the yogurt shop had driven a specific type of vehicle. This caller provided the license plate number for the vehicle and even gave police its approximate location. Police would learn the car was owned and driven by a couple of drug dealers from Bertram, a town nearby. But an exhaustive look at these individuals would prove to be fruitless. They had an airtight alibi, validated by several credible witnesses. Again, investigators went back to the drawing board. In the immediate aftermath of the crime, police would receive more than 1,000 phone calls from people in the area, people who believed that they knew something and tried to help out, however they could. One of these calls came from a local teenage girl who claimed to have been in the vicinity of the yogurt shop on the night of the murders. She implicated her teenage boyfriend in the murders, but police would later claim that her information wasn't credible. The information she reported on to them regarding the crime scene itself seemed to be based almost entirely on gossip, which didn't jive with the facts of the case. And that's what happens, you know. Then, you know, they get these people coming forward, you know, and sometimes you will get people who, you know, will slightly bend the truth, or, you know, to put it bluntly, waste police's very, very valuable time, you know, in these certain cases, which makes it even harder, you know. But that's what the police have to do, unfortunately. To make matters more complicated, investigators also had to deal with a plethora of false confessions, including the one that I detailed in the episode introduction, which was just one of several dozens. Even police would later state that more than 50 people falsely confessed to the yogurt shop murders. That is another thing. A lot of people, will confess that they did it, either because they really believe that, or they just have nothing better to do and they just want to, like, mess around with the police and waste their time. Which, for a lot of the times, that's the case. But when pressed to provide intimate details of the crime scene, either failed to do so or repeated information that wasn't true. It will later be determined that a potential cause of this was the Austin Police Department itself, as not only were police officers potentially soliciting false confessions through coercion or intimidation, but they weren't properly trained in interview tactics. Well, there's the issue. If you're not properly trained in interview tactics, then you know you're not going to be very successful. In at least one case, it was found that a detective working on the yogurt shop murders task force, Hector Polanco, was coercing confessions from people he was interviewing, which included 16-year-old Maurice Pierce. He would later be removed from the task force and eventually fired from the APD for this reason, but was reinstated through an arduous arbitration process, which generally favours police officers. Regardless, his impact on this case cannot be overstated. The extreme number of these false confessions and how police obtained them would go on to play a major role in this case, but that's something I'll explore later on. By the end of December, police made it clear that they had no specific suspects in mind, and with everyone that they had investigated thus far either having alibis or providing information that conflicted with the facts, APD's investigation had established a relatively tight window for this crime to have been committed, sometime between 10:50 and 11:30 p.m. on December 6, 1991, and they had interviewed more than 100 people at this point, many of whom provided them with witnesses that were willing to testify to their presence being elsewhere that evening. In a statement to the press, Lieutenant Andrew Waters, who supervised APD's homicide division, stated, "I'm sorry to say there's little evidence. It's getting very frustrating. We've won through most of the phone tips we've had. The information has dried up, and we haven't gotten anything." In early January, members of the Austin Police Department began making positive statements to the press, claiming that the investigation was preparing to come to an end. According to several members of the APD, they had been aided in their investigation by the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, who hadn't been on a case in Austin in over two decades, but had just recently been profiled in the hit movie The Silence of the Lambs. Now supposedly police were ready to make arrests. On January 3rd, 1992, the first Friday of the year, Sergeant John Jones told reporters, "It would be safe to say an apprehension is imminent. We are confident that this case will come to an end real soon." However, that claim would be backtracked the following Monday, January 6th, which also happened to be the one-month anniversary of the crime in itself. At a press conference announcing the official creation of a task force comprised of a local, regional, state and federal police officials, stated that no arrest was imminent, but they were hoping to find justice for the victims relatively soon. During the press conference, officials would release a more comprehensive profile of the culprits, as they continued to believe that a group of young men had been responsible, either teenagers or men in their early 20s, who were most likely white. The psychological profile they had created narrowed in on the leader of the group, who investigators believed had been the dominant personality among them. According to this profile, the leader of this group likely had less than a high school education, had a history of discipline problems, both anger issues and substance abuse issues, as well as acting out without considering the potential ramifications, avoided fights or confrontations, had a history of unemployment, still lived at home with his parents, There's nothing wrong with that, you know. Was familiar with the area around the yogurt shop, took very little pride in his personal appearance. Regarding this individual, Lieutenant Andrew Waters said, he is under a tremendous amount of stress from fear of detection and apprehension. Because the commission of this crime may not have gone as planned, the offender is very concerned about the loyalty of his accomplices, because he knows they regret their involvement in the crime. Throughout January and February, police in Austin would end up focusing a lot of their efforts on the local alternative community, people that seem to have an interest in the occult or the self-professed Satanists. Or you could just say the alternative people. Just say that. In reality, many of these people were just involved in Austin's underground gothic and industrial movements. But because they wore black and had tattoos and may have listened to heavy metal music at a time in which satanic panic was still very much alive throughout America, they were of the extreme interest to the APD. Investigators began to refer to these individuals as PIBs, people/persons in black. Okay, or you could just call them goth, alternative people, you know, simple. In the weeks after the yogurt shop murders, police spent a lot of time investigating PIBs, believing that the murders might have had some kind of satanic cult angle. Throughout January and February, investigators would begin to harass several members of this underground community, attempting to get friend to testify against friend, grilling people in lengthy police interviews, and trying to figure out intimate details of these individuals' sex lives. How all of this pertains to the actual investigation, I don't know. I just find it very creepy, but, you know. One woman named Claire LeVay was even accused by APD of being part of a satanic cult in the region that participated in illegal activities. 48 Hours had begun putting together a special about the case and were actually filming when police conducted a raid of LeVay's home. Hoping to find proof of satanic sacrifices and grave robbing, the host of 48 Hours, Erin Moriarty, even referred to LeVay as a high priestess, which would turn out to be nothing more than a cringeworthy accusation. The bones discovered in LeVay's house were little more than a clay sculpture and animal bones, and the rumours of her having led a devil-worshipping cult were just that, silly rumours, perpetrated by the same overzealous folks that perpetrated a lot of the satanic panic myths of the 1980s and 1990s. Members of this underground community would later express the belief that Austin police were trying to shut down their movement, having used the yogurt shop investigation as a cover to do so, and that belief would be granted some kind of backing when the police themselves announced that none of the persons in black were suspected of involvement in the yogurt shop murders. By March, police would announce that there was nothing cult-related about the crime scene, but they were unwilling to give up on any lead, no matter how zany or outlandish. Speaking to reporters with the Austin American Statesman, Lieutenant Andrew Waters said, I wouldn't really say a satanic tie is still in our mind, but as far as absolutely ruling it out, I wouldn't say that. Several weeks after the investigation had started, the case began to receive national attention through a couple of high-profile broadcasts. First came an appearance on America's Most Wanted, hosted by John Walsh, was then followed up by an even more in-depth appearance on 48 Hours, hosted by the aforementioned Erin Moriarty. Here, she is in a brief clip asking Sergeant John Jones about the active state of the investigation.
We've got some homicides that have been on the book for a while.
Does that bother you, the thought that it might be right in front of you, right inside your computer?
No, it didn't bother me. If they're here and they're in there, we'll get to them and we'll arrest them.
Can you give me some indication of just how many suspects you've gone through here?
Well, okay. 342.
342 people that you want to talk to in connection with?
That, yeah, 342 people that have been listed as suspect.
Is the murderer of the four girls at the yogurt shop in there, do you think?
Might be. There are several that we haven't got to yet.
Do you have a theory? Do all you guys have a pet theory of...
Of this case? I don't, because that's a why question. And you can get lost in a why question. You can really get lost. I'm more interested in the who. I don't like to get into speculation. Let's hope that this isn't the start of a mass murder going coast to coast. That's why the FBI seem to think that this guy's probably still local. You know, heaven help us all. This guy is a Ted Bundy, a mass...
So, that was a clip of him on 40 Hours. So, as weeks dragged out into the months with no end in sight for the criminal investigation, the loved ones of the victims struggled to move on, especially since they had to do so without any kind of resolution. But with this gaping loss in their lives, first came what would have been Amy Ayers' 14th birthday. On the final day of January 1992, which her family tried their best to celebrate, but the loss of the four girls continued to express itself in other ways. With individuals outside of their families, for example, the FFA chapter that all four had belonged to at Lania High School, was now without its president and several of its members. Their duties had been delegated to other members, who reluctantly stepped up into their positions on a temporary basis. Even the animals that the girls had been raising, some lambs and a pig, were now left by orphaned by the loss of the girls. Other students would have to step up and care for the animals, aware that they could never explain the loss to the creatures. They were just this strange, new, nurturing presence in their lives. In June 1992, Jennifer and Eliza's classmates graduated from Lania High, taking their first steps into a much larger world. The girls' absence was noted by a couple of empty seats at the ceremony, with their classmates acknowledging that even though the two girls couldn't walk with them, their presence would still be felt in the years to come. The loss of the four was impossible to comprehend for the victims' families. While Amy and Eliza's parents had other children that they could care for, their loss was felt heavily. Throughout those first few months, as the major holidays came and went, then the major milestones such as graduation and prom, which would have been joyous occasions but now felt empty and hollow. For Jennifer and Sarah's parents, the tragedy was twofold. Both sisters had been lost in a single evening, and neither of the parents had any other children. Meanwhile, the scene of the crime itself, the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt Shop in the Hillside Centre shopping centre, would never reopen for business again. After being cleared by investigators, the interior of the store was left for weeks before being emptied. All the while, people in the area left mementos outside of the store in the form of candles, balloons and written messages that were meant for the murdered girls. Within a week, the sign on the front of the yogurt shop would be removed. What would follow was a long and arduous process of the building changing owners several times, as the legacy of this crime continued to cast a large shadow over the area. In early February, a series of billboards would be erected throughout Austin, bearing the images of the four girls, along with the question, who killed these girls? Throughout the rest of the year, the reward for the information leading to the identification and apprehension of the culprits would continue to rise, first to $100,000 and then to $125,000, eventually becoming the largest reward offered for any crime in the Austin area. In March of 1992, police began circulating a composite image of a young man whom they believed had been seen in the area of the yogurt shop on the night of the murders. According to at least one witness, this young man had been seen inside of an older model four-door white automobile, which was believed to be a Chevy. This young man was described as standing roughly 5 foot tall, 5 foot four tall, sorry, weighing approximately 140 pounds, having long straight dark hair that reached past his neck, and being of possible Hispanic descent. As soon as this sketch was released to the press, it began to draw immediate comparisons to a similar sketch that Austin police had released just a few months prior, back in November 1991, 1 month before the yogurt shop murders. In that case, three men had kidnapped a woman from outside of an Austin nightclub, driven her to an apartment complex just down the street from the yogurt shop, and then driven her to San Antonio, roughly 80 miles away. Throughout the entire ordeal, the woman had been sexually assaulted by the three men at gunpoint, as she would later describe them all to police. One of these three men was the sketch that was almost identical to the most recent one, released to the press, a young man of similar proportions with long dark hair who appeared Native American in appearance but spoke fluent Spanish. Mexican authorities would later identify the individual from the composite image as Albert Jimenez Cortez, aka the Wizard. He was a member of the Mierdes Punks, a Mexican motorcycle gang, three of whom were believed to have committed the kidnapping and rape of the woman from Austin in November 1991. The leader of this trio was a man named Porfirio Villasevideo, aka the Terminator, who, alongside Cortez, had acted alongside another man, Ricardo Hernandez, aka El Brujo. All had left Austin area shortly after the yogurt shop murders, and were believed to have fled to Mexico. Saavedra and Cortez were arrested by Mexican authorities in October 1992, and were charged with rape, kidnapping from November 1991, in addition to other crimes, such as drug trafficking, because they were Mexican nationals that were in Mexico at the time. They could not be extradited to the United States, but they could still stand for trial for crimes they had committed across the border. However, during the initial questioning, both had supposedly confessed to involvement in the Austin yogurt shop murders, which were still completely unsolved, because one of the men, Cortez, looked like a composite image released by police in that crime. Mexican authorities were sure that this trio had been responsible. A trial began within weeks for the rape case and some of the other charges, but neither Saavedra or Cortez would ever be charged for the Austin shop murders, primarily because there was no evidence linking them to the crime. The composite image released by police was just someone that had supposedly been seen in the parking lot that night, and APD had never named him a suspect, nor positively did Cortez as this individual, but also because both men had recanted their confessions almost immediately. They claimed that they had been tortured by Mexican police during their interrogations and had nothing to do with the yogurt shop crime. Investigators would travel to Mexico on multiple occasions over the next couple of years so that they could meet with detectives down there and interview these two men for themselves, but they were never able to find anything directly linking them to the yogurt shop murders. The two men, Albert Jimenez Cortez and Porfirio Villasevideo, would be convicted for other crimes, but would never stand trial in this case. Meanwhile, their third accomplice, Ricardo Hernandez, would manage to avoid capture in the years to come, avoiding justice for the crimes that he and his cohorts had committed. While investigators were never able to officially clear these three as suspects, they had no reason to believe that any had been involved in the yogurt shop murders. Over the next couple of years, this case would begin to enter a cold case territory. Police were seemingly nowhere close to cracking the case. Having exhausted all of their workable leads, by all accounts, they were right back where they had started in December of 1991. But the momentum that they once had behind them, as well as the public support, was gone. The truth would continue to elude them in the years to come. As the investigation carried on through the rest of 1993 and 1994, change was in the air. The public was not satisfied with the overall lack of answers, and the Austin Police Department, facing pressure from elected officials, began to reshuffle the investigation as it struggled to regain its hearing, its bearing, after a couple of high-profile disappointments. Meanwhile, the task force, once assembled to spearhead the case, started to crumble behind the scenes. Sergeant John Jones, who had been overseeing the case from the very beginning, was soon transferred to the APD's Assault Division, a demotion in all but name. He was ceasing the day-to-day responsibility of the yogurt shop. Case filed, but would remain a consultant on the case for the foreseeable future. Despite senior officials in the APD claiming that Jones had requested the change, Jones himself would dispute that, claiming that he was essentially forced out of not only the case, but the homicide division entirely. However, Jones himself would later admit that the change might have been for the better, as he had started to develop a serious case of PTSD as a result of working this case full time for several months, as he had developed close bonds with the victim's family members and other loved ones. He felt a deep sense of grief not being able to bring them any kind of resolution in the case, as did they, having been unaware of this turnover until they saw it on the news. Sergeant Jones would later describe the administrative turmoil throughout the Austin PD as a major deterrent to the investigation, which had been plaguing it from the start. Speaking to the Austin American Statesman, Jones said about himself and his partner Mike Huckabee, who had single-handedly led the investigation for more than 2 years, "We did the best we could with what we had, and we didn't have much. We could get computers and stuff. The community kicked in and did stuff. We got the space in the North Austin for a task force office, but we just couldn't get personnel. And even though we asked for it, we'd get stuck in petty politics. Sorry. In truth, this kind of dysfunction would stymie a lot of the early investigation. The APD's homicide division had just 6 detectives at the time of the yogurt shop of the murders, which was incredibly small for a city of nearly 500,000 people. Even though Austin's crime rate had been skyrocketing in the years before this crime, the city hadn't invested heavily in its law enforcement division, and it sold in their response to this crime. Meanwhile, the families of the murdered girls would experience some kind of relief that same year. 1994, the year prior, they had filed a lawsuit against the owners of the shopping centre that I Can't Believe Is Yogurt was in. Excuse me. As well as the yogurt chain itself. They alleged that the yogurt chain had not done what it could to protect its teenage employees, and that the owners of the shopping centre had not responded to the shocking amount of robberies leading up to the murders. They claimed that this entire ordeal could have been avoided if either or both had dealt with their security issues beforehand. And yeah, that could be argued. No, I'm not going to say it should not be argued. Of course, things should have better security. You know, by the time this lawsuit came to a resolution, all of the families had moved out of the area, having been unable to continue living in the same houses that the 4 victims had once called home. Throughout the mid-1990s, another prominent suspect would emerge in the form of a serial killer who for decades had been inspiring terror in Texas. In 1966, Kenneth Allen McDuff had just been paroled for the burglary and would go on to commit heinous crime alongside an accomplice. In that case, McDuff and his accomplice would abduct 2 men and a woman at gunpoint, forcing them into a car trunk and then driving them to an isolated location. The two men were shot in the head and the woman was forcibly raped before being strangled to death by Macduff with a broomstick. The crime would later earn the nickname the Broomstick Murders, but would only remain unsolved for a few hours. The following day, Macduff's accomplice, Roy Dale Green, would confess his involvement to police and agree to testify against him in a subsequent trial. Kenneth Macduff was later arrested, charged and ultimately sentenced to death for his crime. During his incarceration, however, the death penalty would be suspended, earning Macduff a stay of execution in 1989. He was granted parole due to an overcrowding issue plaguing Texas prisons, and he became a free man once again. It is believed that almost immediately after his release, Kenneth Macduff started killing again. He is known to have killed several women throughout Texas over the next couple of years, many of whom went missing or their cases unsolved, while Macduff assimilated back into society. All the while he became a violent drunk and a cocaine addict, which only exacerbated his existing issues. Macduff lived in the Austin area, and just a couple of years after his release from prison, would become implicated in the deaths of two women, Melissa Northrup, whom he worked with, and Colleen Reed, a woman that was supposedly abducted from a cash wash not too far from the yogurt shop, the same ones that the yogurt shop murders happened, December of 1991. By the time police suspected Macduff of either, he had already fled the area but was later found to be living in the Kansas City region under an assumed name. Following an appearance on the television programs, America's Most Wanted and Unsolved Mysteries, Macduff was arrested and tried for the murder of Melissa Northrup. He was ultimately found guilty and sentenced to death. Subsequently, he was tried for the murder of Austin's Colleen Reed, whose body had not yet been found but whose disappearance had been linked to Macduff and an accomplice. He was also found guilty in that case and eventually led police to Reed's body just outside of Marlin, Texas. For the next few years, Kenneth Macduff would remain on death row, confessing to several crimes he had already been tied to. In at least a handful of cases, he was able to lead police to the bodies of other women he had killed and disposed of. As his execution date approached in 1998, Macduff decided to throw up a Hail Mary and confess to Austin's most infamous unsolved crime, the yogurt shop murders, which remained unsolved nearly 7 years later. He believed that his confession might perhaps grant him some more time, at least a stay of execution, from the state governor, George W. Bush. But he thought wrong. On November 17th, 1998, Kenneth Allen Macduff was executed by the state of Texas, whatever secrets he might have still had rent with him to the grave. After his death, investigators would compare his confession to their records, which included his fingerprints and DNA, which they could compare to samples recovered from the crime scene. Despite Austin police investigating him as a serious suspect, they could find no visible link between Macduff and the Austin yogurt shop murders, and he was posthumously cleared as a suspect in the case. In January 1996, more than 4 years after the yogurt shop murders, APD Detective Paul Johnson was chosen to begin overseeing the investigation, which had not seen much public activity in recent months. Before he could truly dive into the case, however, he needed to reorganise almost everything about it to try and uncover leaks that might have been glossed over or forgotten about in the maelstrom of those first few years. This was no easy task, considering that the investigation led by Sergeant Jones and others had collected information on more than 1,200 suspects, accumulated more than 5,000 pages of handwritten notes, and a computer case file containing more than 10,000 pages of reports and logs. He would have to begin reorganizing everything into smaller, more manageable files, which he tried to separate by tip and by suspect. As you can imagine, this was an incredibly long, lengthy task, which would go through several starts and stops over the next couple of years. During this time, the original task force, which was comprised of Austin Police, Travis County Sheriff officials, members of the FBI and ATF, and others, would officially disband after several months of inactivity. A second task force would be assembled in its aftermath to reconsolidate assets and information, but that too would die a quick death. It would take a couple of years for this reorganization to truly reap any benefit, as the APD began reaching out to outside agencies for help, not only the FBI and the US Attorney's Office, but the Travis County DA and the Texas State Attorney General. This entire process, which was described by Austin's Assistant Police Chief Michael McDonald as a re-review, was just one of several that would unfold between 1996 and 1999. On December 6th, 1991, we as a city lost our innocence. Today we regain our confidence. The loved ones of the victims expressed gratitude towards the investigators for dedicating so much time to the case over the years, but were too reluctant to begin gloating quite yet. It has still taken police nearly 8 years to arrive at this point, and had done so after only circling back to some early leads that the original investigators had discounted entirely. Doubts would continue to linger in many minds, including in the victims' families. After all, the four young men that now stood accused had themselves been teenagers. The time of the murders and their age was surely going to be a hassle as the inevitable trial moved forward, especially since prosecutors stated that they were going to be pushing for the death penalty. In at least two out of the four cases, the other two, since they had been minors at the time, could only be sentenced to life in prison, while police and prosecutors were assured that they had the culprits of Austin's most high-profile murder case behind bars awaiting trial. A more complicated story would begin to unfold over the next several months, a story that wasn't as black and white as officials would lead the public to believe. This was a much more nuanced story which didn't exchange four bad boys for the four good girls lost nearly a decade prior. Even though police had rolled out these four suspects on a figurative silver platter, their guilt was far from assured. So in the next episode we will be going on to part 3 of the yogurt shop murders, which will be Friday's episode. But that will be it for this episode. I hope you are enjoying the weather wherever you are, and have an amazing day or night wherever you are, and I will see you. You will hear me in the next one, in the next episode. Until then, have a great day, and I will see you soon.
I wonder if God got a plan for everyone. I wonder if I could take a second run. 'Cause I carry on getting sad and getting stuck. What I wouldn't give for a life that doesn't suck. I'm a moving target.